Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working on this pre-recorded program via remote. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, November 8, 2021. South Sudan's Undersecretary in the Ministry of Environment and Forestry says his country is suffering from the effects of climate change.
Our rains usually start in April, but now they are starting late in June and July. Even now, November, we have erratic rainfalls. So our agricultural season is now out of track.
And journalists in Southern Africa say press freedom is under attack.
In the wake of this resolution, we have seen a dangerous consensus towards crackdown of expression online. A number of Southern African countries moved with speed to come up with what they referred to as cybersecurity laws and frameworks.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Undersecretary in the Ministry of Environment and Forestry says the COP26 conference in Glasgow is an opportunity for developing countries to make a case. Joseph Africano Batel says the current climatic changes in South Sudan is due to global warming triggered by activities of developed countries. Batel says climate change has threatened the livelihoods of millions of South Sudanese who depend on agriculture for survival.
Our rains usually start in April, but now they are starting late in June and July. Even now, November, we have erratic rainfalls. So our agricultural season is now out of track. At the same time, we are having flooding, even in Juba, areas of Gumbo, Gudele, Gurei, and also now we have over 5 states that are underwater, Jonglei, Upper Nile, Unity, Awil, and even Central Equatoria and some parts of Meridi too is underwater now.
People hear climate change. It's becoming a buzzword. What causes climate change? You are an environmental expert.
What causes climate change is the development model that the developed country used. Burning of coal and the emissions from burning of fossil fuels. Those kind of like emit carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. And the carbon dioxide that is emitted into the atmosphere, they trap heat, and that results into the warming of the atmosphere. And this warming is now causing what we all know as climate change at the moment.
Our country, it's not so industrialized like the other countries in the West, so that we can say there are a lot of factories, and that is why we are suffering from climate change. I mean, looking at a place like Bantu, there's no factory there. I mean, why would Bantu experience climate change?
The atmosphere doesn't have boundaries. That's why it's a global issue. What is happening in the West is affecting the whole world. So for us, we don't have any option but to adapt to this phenomenon. That's why our position here in these negotiations is to make sure that countries in Africa and ours, for example, is supposed to benefit from the adaptation funds, such that our people will be able to adapt to this new phenomena. Like now, since our backbone of the economy is agriculture, we'd like now to adapt to smart agriculture.
Let's talk about the smart agricultural methods. What does that entail?
The smart agriculture methods is simply we are now going to make sure that we provide drought-resistant seeds to our people, and also we try to give them a capacity to understand the information about the weather conditions. We try to provide them with fertilizers because of the loss of fertility due to the droughts. We also want to make sure that we have intensive land use management. Like now, instead of having clearing the place, we can now have intensive land use management like agroforestry. We can get all systems like agro, pastoral, Sylvie and aquaculture all in the same place. That simply means we have our crops planting in one side, we have livestock, we also have fish ponds, and at the same time plant trees so that we have a full ecosystem in place.
Let's talk about trees here. I've been visiting South Sudan and I'm quite surprised that the vegetation cover that was surrounding Juba town is all gone. Even when you look at Jebel Kujur, you see it all dry, all the trees around there have been cut. And, you know, it's an open secret that soldiers are cutting trees to make charcoal so that they can survive. In a country where the mainstay of other people is the forest, how would you plant trees? You're planting trees and they will cut all of them.
The issue of deforestation in South Sudan is not only an issue for us only to plant trees, but we have to have an alternative for energy, alternative sources for energy. For example, we in government, in our nationally determined contributions to fight climate change, we have to generate at least 3,000 megawatts of energy from clean energy. That's from hydro, solar, wind, geothermal, or even natural gas.
Using hydro does not sound like good news to Egyptians. How would you convince them that you are going to not affect the flow of the Nile?
Currently, we have new technologies where you don't need even to construct a dam. What you just simply need to get is you get the turbines that the river will kind of like turn them in order to produce energy. So the Egyptians, I know, they are kind of like jittery about any project on the Nile, but I think we have technologies that we can use. At the same time, we also don't have to leave because South Sudan is there to support the development of Egypt. We as a country also need to develop. So hydro and any other project that we need as a country has to be conducted.
That's Joseph Africano Batel, South Sudan's Undersecretary in the Ministry of Environment and Forestry. He was speaking with me from Glasgow, Scotland. In the second part of this interview, Batel speaks about environmental pollution in South Sudan. The end of coal is in sight. That's according to Britain, the host of the COP26 climate summit, after dozens of countries pledged to stop using coal and end the financing of fossil fuels. But as Henry Ridgewell reports from the Glasgow summit, winding economies off coal won't be easy even for Britain itself.
Burning coal is the single biggest contributor to climate change. Over 40 countries made pledges Thursday at COP26 to phase out coal entirely by 2030 for rich countries and 2040 for poorer nations. Signatories include big coal consumers like Vietnam, Indonesia, Poland, and Ukraine. They, alongside several global banks and financial institutions, also committed to ending all investment in new coal power generation.
A commitment to end coal investment, to scale up clean power, to make a just transition, and phase out coal in the 2030s in major economies and in the 2040s elsewhere.
But many of the world's biggest coal consumers, including China, the United States, Australia, and India, did not sign the deal. Emissions of CO2, meanwhile, have almost rebounded to pre-pandemic levels.
Behind this, we see a rapid rise in the emissions in China, particularly pushed by probably economic stimulus packages.
Separately, 25 countries, including the United States, also pledged to stop public financing for all overseas fossil fuel projects by the end of next year. But again, key Asian coal investors, China, Japan and South Korea, did not sign up. COP26 host Britain said the flurry of agreements shows the end of coal is in sight, but it still appears some way off. Britain itself is considering opening a new mine to produce coal for steelmaking. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has voiced opposition, but says it's a planning matter for local government. The local mayor supports the mine.
If we're going to have the green industrial revolution that we need in developing solar, wind, wave, and certainly here we'd love to develop more nuclear, it's all going to take significant amounts of steel.
Britain is also considering the development of a new oil field off Scotland's Shetland Islands, not far from Glasgow, host city of the climate summit. Meanwhile, the International Energy Agency said Thursday that if all the commitments made at COP26 so far were fully implemented, global warming would be limited to below 2 degrees Celsius, a significant improvement on the 2.7 degrees Celsius rise the United Nations forecasted before the summit. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Glasgow, Scotland.
Advocates for media freedom say nations in the Southern Africa Development Community, SADC, are enacting restrictive cyber laws that have a chilling effect on journalism and freedom of expression. Columbus Mavunga has more from Harare.
In a hybrid forum on the state of internet regulations, Thabani Moyo, the director of Media Institute of Southern Africa, said his organization is worried about a trend toward less tolerance for journalists and dissent in the region. He said the trend began last year after SADC leaders' meeting where heads of state resolved to take preemptive measures against what they called external interference, the impact of fake news and abuse of social media.
In the wake of this resolution, we have seen a dangerous consensus towards crackdown of expression online. A number of Southern African countries moved with speed to come up with what they referred to as cybersecurity laws and frameworks. To us, somewhat problematic, as the proposed pieces of legislation had serious chilling effects on expression, media freedom, and right to privacy.
The effects have been felt most visible in Tanzania, where the Uhuru newspaper was suspended in August for publishing what authorities called a false story saying President Samia Suluhu Hassan would not run for office in 2025. In September, Raja Mwema, a Swahili language weekly, was suspended for 30 days for reportedly publishing false information and deliberate incitement. Meanwhile, Zambia's government under former president Edgar Lungu used cyber laws to block social media on the pretext the opposition was committing crimes with its posts on Twitter and Facebook. SADC Secretary Elias Mupedi Magosi, in a speech read by SADC Director of Infrastructure Rosemary Mapolayo Mokwena, defended the move toward stronger internet laws.
As more people get connected to access information, it attracts more cyber criminals to our shores. SADC has already commenced the process to review and modernize the SADC cybersecurity legal, regulatory, and institutional frameworks. Misinformation being spread on the safety of 5G mobile networks risks has caused a negative impact on the ICT industry.
However, Namibia's Minister of Information and Communication Technology, Pierre Mushelenga, called on countries to allow free expression online.
It is thus incumbent upon all role players, development partners, civil society organizations, governments and intergovernmental organizations to reinforce cooperation among each others in order to safeguard and enhance guarantees for the full exercise of the right to information and freedom of expression both online and offline, with a particular focus on strengthening media freedom, diversity, its independence and ability, as well as transparency of digital platforms.
Zimbabwe's Information Minister Monica Mchangwa announced this week the government had set up a cyber team to monitor what people send and receive, a move that has been condemned by many rights groups. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, the conflict instability looms in Ethiopia as the Tigray conflict threatens to spread across the country. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the best way to introduce change?
You have to educate. Education is the key factor to change. Without education, people will resist.
You have to educate the person. You have to educate people on the situation on ground, the implication of that situation, and if the change is to come in, what impact is that change going to create?
So the best way to introduce change is to understand the change, and you try to educate the people on what change is all about.
I think just go right ahead and do it, because there are always people who don't really like change, and there are also always people who like change and they're conducive to change. And so I think there's always going to be that one person who's like, no, I don't like this, it's different.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Ethiopians rallied Sunday in support of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's war effort against rebels of the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front. The rally comes as the international community urges the Ethiopian government to end war peacefully. Last week, the U.S. government accused Ethiopia of gross violations of human rights. Dr. Brooke Hailu is an adjunct professor of political science at the University of Maryland and North Carolina A&T State University. He says the demonstrations came to send a clear message to the international community that Ethiopia can address its own problems.
From what I have gathered, the objective and goals of the demonstration was to, in a very clear way, send a signal to the U.S. government and to European governments as well that Ethiopia is capable of addressing its problems and issues, that Ethiopian government is there to listen to what the American government is saying, but when it comes to make some kind of a dictate or diktat, as they say in French or Latin, that it will not allow the interference in the internal affairs of Ethiopia, that the Ethiopian government says that it is being pushed to talk to the rebel group, the TPLF, who were in power for 27 years and who lost power 3 years ago and who want to make a comeback to power again. And thirdly, this is a message of solidarity with the Ethiopian army.
Professor Hailu, you know that the United States government and other Western governments have accused the Ethiopian military of some gross human rights violations. And in fact, there's a threat to remove Ethiopia from the African Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA. Your comment?
Yes. Great questions. When it comes to the Ethiopian-American official relations, it goes back more than 100 years. Ethiopia being the first black African nation, independent nation, to be represented in the USA, as you know, Mr. James. What happened right now is that the government is saying that the war was started officially in November the 3rd and November the 4th, 2020. The war was started by a certain rebel group who has ruled Ethiopia brutally for the last 27 years and wanted to make a comeback. And the Ethiopian government's position is that it is its responsibility constitutionally, as well as what the Ethiopian people expect from it, is to defend the territorial integrity. So that is the issue. And that's the position. And the Ethiopian government and the Ethiopian public are really unhappy and sad. They feel that the American government has taken sides because the American government is pushing the government and the rebels who took up arms and who defied the constitution to be put in equal parity. And the government is saying that that should not be the right position of the American government.
So, Professor Hailu, people say if Prime Minister Abe won the Nobel Peace Prize, how come he cannot come to the negotiation table to end the war peacefully?
That's a great question. Another great, Mr. James. Yes, Dr. Abe was recognized in his first year of office as a peacemaker within Ethiopia, which the TPLF regime was not able to accomplish. And then those group who lost power, they began to agitate and they attacked the Ethiopian federal forces in, as I said already, November 3rd and 4th, that fateful day. And hence, Abe, as the prime minister of the country, as the commander-in-chief of Ethiopia, although he is a peacemaker, he had the constitutional duty and expectation from the Ethiopian government and the Ethiopian people and the army to safeguard the territorial integrity of Ethiopia.
That's Brooke Hailu, an adjunct professor of political science at University of Maryland and North Carolina A&T State University. He spoke with my colleague James Batty from North Carolina. Still on Ethiopia, pressure is mounting on Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, with 9 anti-government factions saying they are now forming an alliance to take power and rebels advancing towards the capital. The U.S. is calling for an immediate ceasefire, as VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Ethiopia's year-long conflict over the Tigray region is reverberating as far as Washington. where demonstrators gathered Thursday near the U.S. Capitol to denounce what they called a genocide by the Ethiopian government and a lack of action by the United States and the United Nations to stop the fighting. Also in Washington, representatives of 9 Ethiopian rebel and opposition groups held a signing ceremony to announce they are joining forces to replace the Abiy government. For his part, Abiy says his government will prevail and has called on residents of Addis Ababa to take up arms if necessary to defend their neighborhoods. U.S. Special Envoy Jeffrey Feltman, who is in the Ethiopian capital, faces a difficult mission. Ahmed Solomon of Chatham House told VOA.
But as I understand it, it's partly there at the invitation of the Ethiopian government. So there could perhaps be an opening. There could perhaps be a scenario where there are discussions about possibility of a ceasefire, the possibility of finding a way through the country's challenges that doesn't involve the conflict spiraling and worsening as it has been doing.
The U.S. is calling on all the parties to negotiate a ceasefire and allow humanitarian assistance to reach the Ethiopian people. Makila James is a former U.S. ambassador with the U.S. Institute of Peace.
The U.S. has always been a friend of the Ethiopian people and has been a real supporter of Prime Minister Abiy. What we're seeing now threatens to undermine all of the progress and the promise of what Prime Minister Abiy came into office to do. And so we hope that this will not be squandered, will not be wasted, and that we can see ourselves all returning to a place where Ethiopia can be an exporter of peace in the region, exporter of development.
The U.S. is working with the African Union, regional allies, and the United Nations to try to create the right conditions for a ceasefire. Here again, Makila James.
So I would say that the collective approach is raising the diplomatic stakes, putting more pressure on the government, giving incentives for the parties to all come to the table, and talking across the board. This is not just a one-sided conversation. It's talking to the TPLF, talking to the Eritreans, talking to the neighbors, talking to the government of Prime Minister Abiy.
The UN Security Council is set to hold a meeting on the crisis in Ethiopia on Monday. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Travel restrictions to U.S. put in place during the pandemic have ended after more than a year and a half on Monday. Travelers from around the world resumed flights to the United States if they are vaccinated. Todd Knopp is a professor of economics and business at the Cornell College in Mount Vernon. VOA's Arish Arabsati asked him to explain what the development means.
Bhavna Patel has been a grandmother for more than a year. She lives in London, but because of travel restrictions due to the pandemic, she's never met her grandson, who lives in New York. Starting Monday, travel restrictions from Britain and several other countries end for vaccinated passengers. Patel can hardly wait.
I want to wear a badge. I'm going to see my grandson. I'm going to, you know, I want a big hat or something. I'm going to see my grandson.
Patel is just one of millions of people who were unable to travel to the U.S. for more than a year and a half. The pandemic restrictions have taken a toll on the U.S. economy in more sectors than just travel and leisure.
As people have traveled less and traveled more, it's played a big role in influencing energy prices and other prices of raw materials. And that then, of course, filters into almost every aspect of the economy.
Professor Todd Knopp says a strong tourism industry inside the U.S. has kept sectors from struggling as much as in other countries that rely heavily on foreign tourism.
Putting restrictions on the travel of human has also put restrictions on the travel in the movement of goods and services. And so in a increasingly globalized economy, at least an economy that was increasingly globalized up to 18 months ago, that has just led to a lot of, I would say, unanticipated bottlenecks.
Bottlenecks like the backup of cargo ships at the key ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles. Ships wait for days to offload their cargo at the congested ports on the West Coast where most products from China enter the U.S. Knopp says supply chain issues will likely have a bigger impact on the economy than travel as the country heads into the holiday shopping season.
A year ago, it was the travel industry that was suffering, but we had positive effects on the supply side from lower energy. Now we're kind of in the exact opposite situation where higher energy prices and supply chain issues are slowing the economy down. But on the demand side, things are strong.
Still, for travelers like Bhavna Patel, the only news that matters is her upcoming flight.
Like, if I could dance, I would dance.
On Monday, the U.S. will also open its land borders with Mexico and Canada to vaccinated travelers. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linor Modou. The World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
That's all we prepared for you this Monday. We now leave you with the song Marata Bed by Emi Iore.
Managing a family is a secret thing, you know. Then it's about in order to the style. Of course, talking about Marata Bed. Marata Bed, oh,
oh.
Yeah, Marata Bed.
We have been listening to Emi Iore with the song Marata Bed. I'm John Tanza. Thanks for allowing us into your vehicles, homes, and phones. Remember to always wash your hands with soap. Practice social distancing and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect you and others from getting COVID-19. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Marata Bed.